trees, it's in you. You don't die, you just get recycled. And of course, from that follows the third lie. You can be like God. Reincarnation. We are evolving. Evolution is not a, in this particular book, and I don't have any copies here to sell you, I don't believe. One of my chapter titles is From Slime to Divine. Because evolution is not a modern scientific theory. You can trace it back hundreds of years BC. It has been part of the occult of Eastern mysticism for thousands of years. What's the point? It's how reincarnation works. What's the point of being reincarnated back here again and again unless you are progressing? You're evolving higher. Let me just give you one. And ultimately the goal is godhood, deity. Deity yoga, the Dalai Lama calls it. You don't have to wait around for reincarnation. You can get it through this altered state. You can achieve it. Now, let me give you one example from the world of the cult. Scientology. Scientology is growing today, believe it or not, even after the death of L. Ron Hubbard. And they're finding a lot of credibility in, you know, among intelligent people. Here's what Scientology says. I'll just give you, I mean, there's so many we could talk about, but let me give it to you in a nutshell. Scientology says that we are all uncreated, omnipotent, omniscient beings called Satan, T-A-T-T-A-N-S. Somebody says that Satan with a lisp. and indeed it is. And we created this MEST, matter, energy, space, time, continuum in which we function. And we became so, and then we created little creatures in it. And we became so intrigued with these creatures that we incarnated them. And as they died and, you know, evolved higher and higher, on the evolutionary scale, we reincarnated and reincarnated and reincarnated until finally, by the time we had evolved, these creatures that we incarnated had evolved to the status of mankind, we were so far removed from our origins as Satan, we forgot who we were. And here we are, gods walking around and don't know it. And so the whole purpose of Scientology is to hit you up to an e-meter. It's a mixture of Eastern mysticism, psychotherapy, and so forth, and regress you back not only into your childhood, but into prior lives where you picked up these engrams, and to deliver you from all of these things, these not only childhood traumas, but traumas from past lives, and break through and to what's called clear, and you become an operating Satan once again. I haven't noticed any of them operating, but they will seriously say, yes, I'm God, I'm an operating Satan. Well, let me see if you demonstrate it. They can't do it. It's a lie. And here is the origin of this lie. So, he says, God, a force. It's in everything. So you don't die, you just get recycled. And you keep coming back because you're on a journey to godhood. You can be like God. And then the fourth lie, of course, is it's in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's nothing wrong with you, it's the way you think. You've just been deceived. You're caught in the downward spiral of your own negative thinking. Oh, now we get to negative and positive thinking, okay? John Mark Templeton, let's go back to him for a moment. Remember John Mark Templeton? The Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, okay? The Wall Street money manager. If you went back, I think it would be, just going by memory, unfortunately I don't have a copy with me, summer of 1986, I think you would find him on the front cover of Possibilities magazine, Robert Schuller. The major interview was with John Marsh Templeton. And the first question asked him was, to what do you attribute your great success? And he said, probably to my concept of reality. I have become convinced that nothing exists except God. Everything's God. You're God, I'm God. You know, that explains why the world's in a mess. Doesn't offer any hope, as we've already said. This is pantheism. This is Hinduism. And it's honored in Robert Schuller's Possibilities magazine. A little later in the article, he says, yes, I have become convinced that Jesus lives in everybody, whether they know it or not, even whether they believe in him or not. Now, let me explain how this works. God is all. God is good. God is all. Therefore, if you see something out there that looks like it isn't good, pain, sickness, suffering, death, it doesn't exist. But you, the problem isn't out there. The problem is in your mind. You have misperceived reality. You've been told for so long, you know, and we're all in this thing together, and we all believe this common lie that limits our ability. And what you need to do is change your thinking. You're caught in the downward spiral of your negative thing. You need to become a positive thinker. And when you begin to think positively, then you change everything. It's, again, an incredible lie. But the problem is the way you think. And you need to be initiated into this knowledge, secret knowledge, the tree of knowledge, with the dark and a light side, black magic and white magic, evil and good. And you need to understand who you are and the power that you have within you. It's laid out for us very clearly there in Genesis. Now go to Second Thessalonians chapter 2. And I believe we have the religion of Antichrist quite clearly presented to us. Verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, that is the day of the Lord, which I believe begins with the rapture. Verse 2, he's saying, I don't want you to be shaken in mind or troubled by word or spirit letter, as for us that the day of Christ is at hand, or had already come, it really says in the margin here, my King James. Why would they be upset if the day of the Lord had come? I think those terms are used synonymously. Christ is the Lord. If they believed in a post-tribulation rapture, well, I won't get into that at this moment, but if they believed in it, why, they'd be happy. Well, tribulation is here. Day of the Lord's begun. Let's get on with it. I mean, we've got to face the Antichrist, and if we survive, why, we'll be raptured. They would only be upset if they had been taught, as Paul, I'm sure, taught them, that it begins with the rapture. And either Paul has been lying to them or they've been left behind. But he goes on, he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, same terminology that Jesus used, that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. I think that happens afterwards. And verse 6 says, you know what withholdeth or prevents him that he might be revealed in his time. But we're not going to get into that. Verse 4, talking of the man of sin, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Amazing. On the one hand, he's an atheist. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. He does not believe in the God of the Bible. He does not believe in the God who created the universe, but he believes that we are all gods. Now, I think we would most, if not all, agree that this verse 4 speaks of a man, the Antichrist, who will ultimately sit in a temple that will be rebuilt in Jerusalem. It pertains to a temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem, but it has an obvious secondary application. Our body is supposed to be the temple of the Holy Spirit. What know you not that your body is the temple of the Spirit that you have of God and you're not your own? And for the first time in the history, this is one of the signs of the end, for the first time in the history of the world, not just a handful of yogis and gurus over in India or in the East, but millions and millions of people throughout the Western world are looking within themselves, looking within what ought to be the temple of God to discover their higher self and to realize they are God. The religion of the Antichrist, I believe, is presented to us here, and it's already on this earth. Now, I mentioned a connection with psychology. And a friend of mine, a rather courageous woman, 6 minutes left. Oh my goodness, I'm just going to end up telling you this story, I think. Rather courageous woman, she took what I was saying with a grain of salt. At least she wanted to check it out for herself. She went to, I wish she were here to tell you this. She went to a regional conference in Indianapolis of the Association for Humanistic Psychology. And she and her husband, and they managed to get in without paying the $125 fee or whatever it was. They're on doing research. And they went into this room it's a little bit larger than this. And there were a group of, these are PhDs and MDs. And they were cutting out, they were drawing like squirrel's faces and cat faces and cow faces and serpent faces and coloring them, like kindergarten, and cutting them out and then putting them on themselves. As she and her husband are sitting there trying to not be conspicuous, watching this, wondering what in the world is going on. Now, these are leading psychologists and psychiatrists. They had a pentagram in the floor. And they dimmed the lights, and the person who's leading us says, now we will channel these creatures, the spirits of the creatures. And the crow says, I have just come from the North Country, and it's very cold up there, and I've come down here to get warm. And they went around the room, and these various creatures are channeling this great wisdom. And they had all finished, and the woman who was leading it said, now, is there a message from anyone else? I said she was courageous, more courageous than her husband. She didn't step in the pentagram, but stepped to the center of the room, and she began to quote John 3:16. And she and her husband said there was a rustling of unease among these creatures behind their masks, and crow, crow, crow. You know, the crow begins to, and the lion begins to roar, and the serpent starts coming out. You know, and they ran out of there. Now, I mention that to tell you these are highly educated people. Okay, I have here 22nd Annual Meeting, Association for Humanistic Psychology. Marilyn Ferguson, one of the speakers who wrote the classic on the New Age. Russell Swikart, one of our astronauts. The daily schedule, early morning, yoga, tai chi, meditation. Some of the institutes, visualization and healing. Trance states and healing. Shamanism is a 100,000-year-old traditional body of knowledge and so forth. which have become important to Western psychology and health practices. Creativity and leadership, being the wizard we are, the magician, to create our own reality. Talking about various forms of Eastern meditation. Consciousness software. Tapping deeper levels of intuition and creativity developed from guided imagery. We'll, in the afternoon, God willing, if the Lord hasn't come, and I wish He would. we will come back and talk about that, because that is so important. Listen, this final one. Education as alchemy. The art of transformational teaching. You need to know this. They are deliberately determined to transform the children in public school. We will present a practical method for educating the whole student, back to where we began, holistic, mind, body, spirit, and so forth, for educating the whole student using mythology, guided imagery, ritual, and so forth. Another one, Adventures in Consciousness, the self-exploration. It's taught by the same gentleman who taught this, first one here, Adventures in Self-Exploration, Holonomic Healing. Psychology has become the umbrella that gives a sense of respectability. It is a major vehicle for bringing these things into the Western world. In fact, the Western psychologists speak of the yogis, the gurus, the shamans, the witch doctors. They call them the ancient psychologists. And they talk. Edgar Mitchell, which I didn't read yet, who was raised as a Baptist, who renounced his faith, who does no longer believe in this God, who believes we are all God, and so forth. He talks about this new wisdom that he has as the ancient wisdom, as I mentioned earlier. Indeed it is. Ancient as the Garden of Eden, exactly where it comes from. Well, I hope there's some cohesiveness to this. I think you can see some connections, and we will come back and speak more of it later. Try not to get into too many more details. It's just such a big topic, and we have a short time. Well, I'm just going to have to forget reading what Edgar Mitchell had to say. I just read one brief quotation. He said, "I simply don't accept the notion of an anthropomorphic deity pulling the strings. I believe that the God power, if you will, resides in all nature and reaches its peak, at least in our corner of the world, in the intellectual striving of the human being." The man who was raised Baptist, and who had that mystical experience on Apollo 14. I want to read again that letter that I began with. Is that okay? Then you'll see it in a new light now. In your book, you compared the worldwide religion, coming in with statements of love and peace and going out with horror and suffering, to the flower child movement of the 60s. By the way, did anybody purchase, I think we had a few copies of Cult Explosion. Does anybody have a copy that they could just hand up here and let me read out of? Could I just take a quick look at that? Thank you. By the way, if you don't get our newsletter, do we have a sign-up sheet back there?
I already talked about it.
Oh, you have, okay.
It's going around the
room. Oh, good, okay. All right. Okay. I don't have a pen. Thank you. What's your first name? George. Okay. Oh, there it is. What is this? Third of April. Already. Okay. This, by the way, thousands of cult members and occultists have come to Christ reading this. This is a different kind of a book on the cults. And when you loan it to a cult member, you want to tear this back page out back here, because that tells you where you will find, like if he's a black Muslim, a Buddhist, a Christian Science, whatever, that'll tell you where to find it. And we don't want him to do that. Because there's not a chapter on this and a chapter on that and a chapter on that, but it's all interwoven through there. They're going to have to read the whole thing to find out what it says about their group. Well, what they basically will find out is that they're not unique, that they're all the same. But I'm quoting a young man. He's a medical doctor right now. But he was a young man when I interviewed him. And I think you would find this interesting in relation to this letter that I'm reading. And I just took this right off the tape. He said, when I first took LSD, I took weak enough doses just to have fun and see colors and psychedelic patterns. But when I started taking really heavy doses, I entered into a relationship with a spirit being. I got a spirit guide. Now, I didn't explain, but I'm sure you all know that the New Testament comes down very hard on something that it calls sorcery. And the Greek word translated sorcery in the King James is pharmakos or pharmakia, from which we get the word drugs. A sorcerer is a person who takes consciousness-altering drugs in order to contact spirit beings to gain supernatural powers. A shaman, witch doctor. So he says, I got a spirit guide. He wasn't looking for a spirit guide, but that's what he got. After that, whenever I took psychedelic drugs, I was always guided by spirit beings. I had spirit teachers showing me lessons, making diagrams right in front of me. One of the first times I took a strong dose of LSD, I had a lesson in astrology. I saw all the signs of the zodiac and how they related to the planets and how that affected my life. I'd never read anything about astrology. Maybe I'd seen something in a paper, but I had no interest. Now I was awed. The whole thing was laid out in living color. Big charts, information being printed right in front of me by spirit beings. Just to give you a quick explanation of astrology. Astrology is based upon the belief that there is a force, the Star Wars force that permeates this universe, such that, depending upon the date and the time and place of your birth in relation to certain heavenly bodies, it will influence your destiny and determine your personality and so forth. That's astrology in a nutshell. So you see how the whole thing all relates. He says, on another LSD trip, the spirit guides taught me about Hinduism. I had never read anything about it. They taught me the highest Hindu vibration, Om. I don't want to ruin this book by propping it open. One of the books I think I mentioned, Death of a Guru. Thousands of Hindus have come to Christ through reading that. I think we have a brother here who was a missionary where this dear man came from, in Trinidad. He was a Hindu guru who came to Christ. When he moved to London to study medicine, on the streets of London, this was in the 60s, he met his first drug users. To his astonishment, they were Hindus, most of them. They had never studied Hinduism. They'd never been on the road to they'd never been to India, to Goa Beach, where all the hippies ended up. But on their drug trips, which sounded very much like his meditation, his yoga, his astral travel, they had met the same gods, had contacted the same beings, and had and developed the same philosophy. That's why Timothy Leary, remember him, Harvard University psychologist who got involved in drugs? When he wrote the psychedelic adventure, He used the Bardo Fodal, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was supposedly written by Tibetan monks who remained conscious during the reincarnation process. He used that as his guide to an LSD trip, because basically it's the same. However you enter the altered state of consciousness, it doesn't matter. Rabbi, Rabindranath Maharaj, one day, he'd been witnessing to this drug user, and he went to his apartment, and the door was sort of half open, and he heard rock music, and there were strobe lights going on, and he knocked, but no one answered, and so he pushed it open and went in. And there, in the center of the floor, to rock music and under the influence of drugs, he saw this young man going through a very highly structured dance that you would see the Hindu girls in the temple would do it. And it was a very highly structured dance, this going through all of the motions. And he had never been to India, had never seen this in his life. So you see, there is a deceiver out here. And when you open yourself up, he begins to lead down that path. So he says, on another LSD trip, the spirit guides taught me about Hinduism. I had never read anything about it. They taught me the highest Hindu vibration, Aum. I saw the whole universe dissolve into vibrations and started seeing vibrations of energy coming out of phone wires. The spirit showed me that everything came down to one basic vibration, the Aum. I saw vibes in people. Remember when the kids were talking about vibes? I had never talked to anyone about Hinduism in my life. Didn't have the vaguest idea about it. I lived in Woodlake, California. That's a very tiny little town. If there were ever any people into Hinduism in Woodlake before me, I never ran into them. I had quit high school and devoted my life to taking drugs. With spirits teaching me, I thought I'd entered into a higher education. I thought this was really more worthwhile than just dull stuff in school. One of my friends was taught transcendental meditation by spirits on an LSD trip. He never had any teaching from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Here comes Maharishi Mahesh Yogi teaching a certain form of yoga, transcendental meditation, and here's a young man gets it on an LSD trip. The whole thing, the initiation ceremony and everything from spirit beings. He didn't have to pay Maharishi a dime. So you have some understanding of where this comes from. Let me say just a word about TM. One of the best books out there is called Transcendental Misconceptions by R.D. Scott. He was an instructor in Transcendental Meditation. And he tells how when he received his first mantra. I remember being on a television show, secular show, and we were having a debate with reincarnationists. One thing leads to another. I should say a word about reincarnation. So if I don't come back to that way, you can ask me. And this, the hostess, well, there was a host and hostess, and the hostess had been involved in TM. So I said, tell me your mantra. Now, mantra is a sound that you repeat over and over. I said, tell me your mantra. She said, oh, no, we can't tell that. I said, come on, tell me your mantra. I said, didn't Maharishi tell you this had nothing to do with religion? It's purely scientific? If this is scientific, how come you can't tell me your mantra? Sounds like hocus pocus. She wouldn't tell me her mantra. I said, I'll tell you why. Maharishi told you not to tell your mantra to anybody because he told you he lies. I said, I wish I had him right here on TV. I'd like to talk to him. He is a liar. And I said, he told you that you received an individual personal mantra, right? There are only 16 or maybe 18 mantras at the most. And they are given to you on the basis of your age and sex when you were initiated. And if you began telling people your mantra, if TMers told people their mantra, they would soon find out that there are thousands of people who have their individually chosen mantra, and the man is a liar. So, R.G. Scott said, When I was initiated into it, I received a mantra. Aing was the name. A-A-I-N-G. And I was told it was a meaningless sound that would help develop my full potential and so forth. What he said, as I progressed upward in the organization, I appeared before Maharishi again. And, well, first of all, before that happened, he had been reading a book on Hinduism, and there, to his astonishment, he found his individual personal mantra. And it was the name of a Hindu god. And so he said, the second time I appeared before Maharishi, he gave me another word to add to my mantra, nama. Well, it's a Sanskrit word that appears 26 times in the initiation ceremony. And he, as an instructor, they say it all in Sanskrit, but he knew the translation. It means, I bow down to you. So he said, I said to Maharishi, what's going on? I was told that this was strictly scientific, has nothing to do with religion, and I find that my mantra is the name of a Hindu deity. And now you give me a word to add on to it that means, I bow down to you. Maharishi said, well, I'm sorry, a lot of people waiting to see me don't have time to talk about it, we'll discuss it later, which they never did. And he said, the third time I appeared before Maharishi, he gave me another word to put in the front of it, S-R-I, pronounced Shri. It means almost beautiful. So now his mantra was Shri Aing Nama, almost beautiful Aing, you Hindu god, I bow down to you. Now, if you read the books on yoga by the great yogis, they will tell you that a mantra is the name of a spirit being, a god. And that the repetition of this is a call for this entity to come and possess you. So I've been interviewed TMers who repeating their mantra going into this altered state, and suddenly they find themselves up on the ceiling looking down their body. Now, they're not out of their body. As James says, as the body without the spirit is dead. So faith without works is dead also. It's a demon playing a videotape in your brain. I mean, that's the best way I could put it. It's a delusion. You're not out of your body, but you're given a delusion. Or they've got a demon on each side trying to possess them, and they wonder what in the world has happened. Some of them go insane. They commit suicide, and so forth. Transcendental meditation. Very dangerous. And if I had stood here 50 years ago and said, you mark my words, in a few years, you are going to see millions of people across the Western world going into an altered state of consciousness, calling upon demons to possess them. And that our whole society, and I've got to hurry quickly and get to the business world and so forth, that our entire society, from the business world, psychology, medicine, education, the public schools, will be training themselves. It's not a matter of some demons floating around trying to zap people, but that our society is literally training themselves to be demonized. You would have thought I was crazy, but it is happening. And of course it was the drug movement that opened millions of our young people to the cosmic gospel of the gurus. And then they flooded our shores. And America was ripe to hear this message. He says, later on, we were heavily influenced by the Beatles. They had a record called Revolver that I'd heard but didn't understand until I heard it again in about 1968, one time when I was stoned on drugs. The song was teaching meditation. It said, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. Listen to the voices. Are they not speaking? It was about spirit beings guiding you into cosmic consciousness. A lot of the stuff the Beatles put into their albums later on, like Sgt. Pepper, had all kinds of enticements to get kids into LSD. Magical Mystery Tour had a lot of Eastern mysticism in it. They encouraged LSD, and then later advocated Maharishi Mahesh Yogi after they'd quit taking drugs and gotten into TM. Sometimes a mother or father says to me, well, my son or my daughter used to be on drugs, but now they're into yoga, and I don't understand this yoga thing, but thank God at least they're off drugs. And I have to say, I'm sorry to inform you, Drugs was a kindergarten. Yoga is a graduate school. They've moved into the hard stuff now. You can get a whole lot higher on yoga than you ever could on drugs. He says, I accepted everything the spirits taught me because it had to be truth coming from the universal self. I began to believe that was what God was. I started to believe that God was the Aum, and the universe was just Maya, an illusion, and so forth. This goes back to the gentleman back there. So, back to this letter. She was part of the Flower Child movement. I recall how exciting it seemed to be young in that era, part of a pulse that throbbed around the world. My friends and I felt that we were part of a global confederation of youth, given a new vision of peace, love, and brotherhood, bonded by drugs and music. It all seemed so new and wonderful going in. Coming out was another story. I was fortunate to get out with my mind intact, though it took me years to recognize and be freed of the spiritual bondage I'd entered. Other friends were not so lucky. Death, broken minds, and spirits were the order of the day. I wasn't even a full-fledged hippie, just a straight Baptist kid dabbling in fun like drugs and forms of Satanism I didn't recognize then but do now. Today, I see it for what it is and am amazed at how I was deceived earlier. What did Jesus say? Beware that no man deceive you. So the time of great deception is coming. Paul said, don't let anyone deceive you. That day will not come, except there come the apostasy and so forth. I've talked with other non-Christian friends, and we've mused about that era, how after it was over, but it's not over, and I want to show you that, we look back on it in disbelief as if we'd been hypnotized for a time. How about that? Well, is it over? No. The hippies, the barefooted or sandal-footed, bearded, long-haired hippies of the 60s are today's political leaders, today's psychiatrists, medical doctors, and professors in the university. So now we're being fed it from the top down. It may not surprise you to know that Al Gore, our vice president, is a flaming New Ager. He is into all of this. Worships Mother Earth, and that's his interest in the environmental movement. And I could go on and talk about that, but we don't have time. What about the business world? See, this is not all that new, but it is accelerating. And in The Seduction of Christianity, I begin the first chapter mentioning a man named Napoleon Hill. How many of you have heard of Napoleon Hill? Well, several of you. Napoleon Hill. It is just incredible. I have a copy of his original book, Think and Grow Rich, written back in 1947, and it has the endorsement of, I think, four or five presidents and ex-presidents of the United States. The endorsement of all the founders of the major industries in the United States all endorsed this. And if you asked a businessman today, they would say that that book, Think and Grow Rich, has influenced more leading businessmen than any other book, Napoleon Hill. What was the... what was the basis of his inspiration? Napoleon Hill said he discovered that there was out on the astral plane a... Now, as I say this, you think, why in the world is this man talking about this? I mean, this is so ludicrous. It is so absurd. But yet it influences millions of people. These are brilliant people. Brilliant in some ways. And badly deceived in others. He said, I discovered that out on the astral plane there was a temple of wisdom run by a school of masters called the Venerable Brotherhood of India. These are ancient beings that have evolved to a higher dimension and so forth. And he said one evening, one of these entities came across the astral plane in disembodied form and manifested itself in my study, and in a vibrant musical voice said, "You have been under the guidance of the great school for years, and we have chosen you to give the formula of success to the world." And the formula of success, that formula of success, literally given by demons, are you following me? To Napoleon Hill, became the foundation of the entire positive mental attitude, success, motivation world of training in the business world out there today. And it was Napoleon Hill who, along with W. Clement Stone, wrote the book called Success Through a Positive Mental Attitude. Okay? And that is where this idea came from the demons. And the root idea that they gave him was whatever the human mind can conceive and believe, it will achieve. In other words, the power is in your mind and it is unlimited. Now, it might interest you to know that W. Clement Stone is on the International Board of Robert Schuller Ministries. He heads the Napoleon Hill Foundation, which gives a gold medal award. Each year one of the recipients has been Robert Schuller and various others and so forth. W. Clement Stone, a very wealthy insurance man, who put up the $1 million for Robert Schuller to send out 250,000 copies of one of his books. His book was titled The New Self-Esteem, The New Reformation, which he sent to all pastors and seminary professors and even many seminary students. And the basic message in that book is, we are not bad. We are simply badly informed about how good we are. And that it is an insult to the integrity of any human being to call him a sinner. That Jesus would never call anybody a sinner. That you need to build up a person's self-esteem and tell them how wonderful they are, that they're worth it, and so forth. Robert Schuller, speaking at Unity School of Christianity. Now I'm kind of moving a little farther now. Unity School of Christianity, you know that? It's a cult. One of the most deadly, dangerous cults in the world. It has its headquarters at Lee's Summit, Missouri. Unity, basically, unifying all religions. There are many organizations attempting to do this. You see, when you attempt to bring, like religious science, science of mind, when you attempt to bring a Hinduism and Christianity together, then you've got the most deadly combination. And Robert Schuller, they would deny that he was there, but I went there and got this tape, and now they deny that such a talk was ever given. And you can't find this tape, except we could send you a copy if you're interested in it. But when Robert Schuller went to Unity School of Christianity to speak to the ministers in training, not to correct them, but to commend them, and to share his church growth principles to help unity grow larger. And in the question and answer time, he was asked, "Dr. Schuller, we hear a lot about the New Age movement these days. And they wanted to explain what it meant and which we are all a part." The questioner said, I quote this in Seduction of Christianity, by the way. And the questioner said, "In your opinion, what is the function of a minister in the New Age?" He didn't skip a beat. He didn't deny he'd ever heard of it. He didn't deny he was part of it. He said, "In the New Age, what we have to do is positivize religion." He said, "That's very easy for you. Being unity ministers, you are already very positive, but you understand I deal with people you would even call fundamentalists. And they use terms like sin and guilt and repentance and redemption. And what we have to do is positivize this." Okay? Now, that brings us to positive and negative. I hate those words. We want to be positive, don't we? Well, if you're talking about magnetism, you're talking about electricity, you're talking about chemical bonding, then positive and negative has some meaning. If you're talking about morals, if you're talking about truth, it has no meaning. And talk of positive or negative becomes a smokescreen that obscures the issue. The issue is it biblical or not biblical? Is it true or is it false? And you can't say that Jesus was positive. I mean, after all, Jesus said, Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies and there won't be one stone left upon another. Well, that's pretty negative. Was that a negative confession, as Kenneth Copeland would say? And so he brought it about. He caused it by his negative confession. Because there's power in words. And when you speak, if you say, I'm getting a cold, you get a cold. If your nose is running and you say, I don't have a cold, keep saying it and eventually you won't have a cold. It may take 3 or 4 days. But they literally come to believe these ideas. And I'm telling you, it came from the spirit world through demons to Napoleon Hill, and that became the foundation of what you will study in the business world: success, motivation, positive mental attitude training. The idea that you can change reality with your mind. This is just another form of what we've been talking about. Now, I want to just give you a couple of other illustrations here, because we won't turn to it, but 1 Timothy 4:1, you know what it says. Now the Spirit speaketh expressly, so you better pay attention to it. In the latter times, what are some of the marks of the last days? In the latter times, what? Some will depart from the faith. We read, and we quoted it several times, Paul says, 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no